It's Wednesday, May 4, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The world continues to discuss one issue, and basically now one issue only, and that is the killing of Osama bin Laden this past Sunday. The world is taking its scale of what happened, its estimation of its meaning, and as the continuing discussions now reverberate throughout the world cultures, one of the things we come to understand is that people are asking very basic questions, such as, what does this mean for the war on terror? What does this mean for the future of Al-Qaeda? Politicians are wondering, what does this mean for the future of President Barack Obama as he is seeking re-election in 2012? Others are asking, what does this mean in terms of U.S. military involvement in Pakistan and in Afghanistan? One very key question here has to do with that very issue. How exactly are we related to Pakistan? One of the old mottos of foreign policy is that nations have no permanent allies and no permanent adversaries. As national interests change, as international events change the complexion of the world, nations that have been allies one minute may be enemies the next. Now, here we are reminded of the fact that we, as individuals, generally act out of what we consider to be our own best interest. So also do nations. Nations act out of what they consider to be their own best interest. They may be best situated at present to be allies with one country, but when issues divide them, they may be adversaries in short order. In a fallen world, the simple truth is that we, as individuals and as collectives, tend to act in our own best interest, and in the world of realpolitik, in the world of foreign policy, one of the most important principles to remember is that the world changes, and so also do the political alignments. This leaves Pakistan right now in a very awkward situation. With Osama bin Laden found and thus located just 2,000 feet from Pakistan's most elite military college, and known to have been there now for a matter of months, Pakistan's in the very awkward position of having to explain itself in terms, first, of being perhaps incompetent to locate Osama bin Laden and to know that he was there in their midst in an easily identifiable fortified compound, or, secondly, that he was indeed there under some kind of Pakistani protection. Now, there have been long-standing allied concerns that the Pakistani military and intelligence circles have been infiltrated by forces friendly to Osama bin Laden and to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. But this leaves Pakistan in this most awkward position. Whether an individual or a nation, it's difficult to explain yourself in terms of being either incompetent or basically complicit in evil. But Pakistan is now in this very awkward position. That's why you're hearing all the complaints about the violation of its sovereignty by forces of the United States in this military operation. And that's another topic of interest, isn't it? The more we come to know this military operation, the more impressive it is. This is an incredible achievement of U.S. Special Forces, an incredible achievement of military intelligence. And any way you look at it, it was an audacious act undertaken by an American presidential administration, and in this case it worked. Now, the headlines that have come in the last few hours indicate that this was, as is so often the case in great events in history, a fairly closely run operation. The distinction between success and failure, well, it could have been a very thin knife's edge, especially as the details come into us about this particular event. Well, even as Americans celebrate the fact that there is now closure in the case of Osama bin Laden, and this great threat to American and international tranquility has been removed, we are reminded that the war on terror continues. And in this case, it is a headline in the New York Times that reads like this: Boy set off Afghan blast near border, official says. Alyssa Rubin, reporting from Kabul in Afghanistan, tells of a boy who entered a village center near the Pakistan border, killing at least 4 people and wounding 14. And as it turns out, the bomber in this case was a 12-year-old boy identified by one Afghan leader. It is not known exactly how old the boy was. However, residents saw a young boy who was not known locally come into their district center shortly before the bomb exploded. Now, in terms of worldview analysis, here is a very hard question. What kind of worldview produces 12-year-old boys ready to blow themselves up and to kill as many others with them as they find possible? That is one of those great questions that should cause tremendous struggle on the part of American Christians trying to understand what is going on in the world. In terms of worldview, what kinds of presuppositions, what kinds of convictions, what kind of warped worldview would lead a young boy to believe that such a thing would make sense, that he was doing what was right and righteous by strapping a bomb upon himself and going into a center and detonating the bomb? What kind of worldview would compel him to believe that he was serving the cause of God by killing himself and as many others as possible by means of this bomb? It is one thing to convince young men in their 20s to take on this kind of suicide mission. It's yet another to convince a young boy of 12. And yet the headlines compel us to ask these questions. Speaking of questions, a lot of people across the American South continuing to ask questions about the meaning of the events that are represented by the tremendous storms that are now known to have been so deadly. The Associated Press reports that the storms that ravaged the Southeast last week killed at least 342 people, thus eclipsing the 1974 outbreak of tornadoes that killed roughly 300. The death toll state by state at this point read Alabama 250, Mississippi 35, Tennessee 34, Georgia 15, Virginia 5, Louisiana 2, and Kentucky 1. Cities such as Cullman and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, have been especially hard hit. And over the weekend, the interesting stories, very heart-moving stories, had to do with churches and families trying to reconnect and regather in the aftermath of these murderous storms. I've spoken to officials in Baptist life and in the community life of many of these southern towns, and it is clear that they know they're going to need help from afar. It is interesting, and I think we should ponder for just a moment the fact that were it not for the killing of Osama bin Laden on Sunday, we would be certainly have been talking about these events and these storms and the great tragedy and travail left in their wake. But all it takes is one news story on the international scene, and the tragedy and the great harm that has come to our neighbors can often be eclipsed. This is where Christians need to make certain that we're looking not only to the television screen and to the internet screen, but also to our own neighborhood and to our own friends and our own country. And we need to be praying for and seeking to assist those who are trying to rebuild lives throughout much of the American Southland. And of course, it's not just the storms that have ravaged the Southland, it's also the rising floodwaters that include especially the systems connected with the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. As the Associated Press reports, the Army Corps of Engineers exploded a large section of a Mississippi River levee on Monday night in what is described as a desperate attempt to protect the Illinois town of Cairo from rising floodwaters. The floodwaters are now seeping through much of Illinois and Mississippi and Missouri and Kentucky and Indiana as the Ohio and Mississippi rivers rise to record flood levels. Some are estimating that the surge on the Mississippi River could be at the highest since the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. On the Ohio River, it may be the highest since the Great Flood of 1937. Meteorologists are explaining that the region has received between 4 and 6 times its usual rainfall. In a fallen world, we know things are out of proportion. Not only are things, humanly speaking, out of proportion in terms of our behaviors and attitudes, but the cosmos bears testimony to the fallenness of the world and to the effects of human sin, even in terms of meteorology. Some parts of the world have too much water, some too little. Some parts have great tornadoes causing this kind of damage. Others suffer by freeze or by drought or by wildfire. We're living in a world that shows the ravages of sin, and a world that can sometimes be deadly as those catastrophic events take place by weather or earthquake or other kind of what is called natural cause. But the reality is that the world can turn hostile on us in short order. Out of the sky, blue one moment, can come a dark cloud. Out of that cloud can come a funnel cloud. And out of that cloud can come death and mayhem. And there are all too many people in America this day who know it all too real. There's an interesting aspect of what went on last week with the royal wedding in Great Britain. Of course, someone has to measure it in terms of ratings. According to Lauren Scherr with the Wall Street Journal, an average of 22.8 million total U.S. viewers tuned in to watch the royal wedding live from 6 a.m. to 7:15 a.m. Eastern Time on Friday. The Nielsen company that conducts such rating services has estimated this. That's about as many people who watch a top-rated primetime show, such as a typical episode of American Idol. It's a fifth of the people who tuned in to watch this year's Super Bowl. Now, does that viewership sound low to you? Well, if it does, it's higher than that of the great royal wedding of Charles and Diana that took place back in 1981. Approximately 14.2 million U.S. households watched that wedding. Approximately 18.6 million watched this one. Many people are talking about the meaning of this event, and most people are simply signing it off as a part of, well, royalty watching or the current cult of the celebrity, and that's most of the story. But there's something else there, isn't it? If you did happen to see all or part of that service, one of the most amazing things is how much of traditional biblical Christianity was contained within the service. The service was basically from the Book of Common Prayer. It included some of the most majestic gospel and scripture intensive language you could imagine. Many of those words familiar to us in terms of the marriage ceremony go back, of course, to the Book of Common Prayer and in its pristine form as it was read with such elegance in the course of that service. The music represented the very best of the English church music tradition. The choirs, the anthems, the hymns, they were all saturated with biblical truth. And yet there stood a young couple, celebrated for their marriage, who had basically been in a pattern of open cohabitation for the better part of the last decade. There you had in the audience persons who clearly did not know how to sing the hymns. One of the most awkward moments in terms of that telecast was when the camera was on the congregation there in historic Westminster Abbey, where, after all, historic weddings have taken place for almost a millennium, and it was clear that they did not know the words to the hymns and probably were not paying much attention at all to the meaning of those words. And yet, somehow, that becomes a very poignant symbol of our day, doesn't it? In a postmodern age, the words are still said for those who have ears to hear, and still sung for those who have tongues to sing. One of the interesting developments in the last few days is the realization that social media has taken over so much of our communications, load, but there's no other way to put it. For instance, many people were watching the events related to the killing of Osama bin Laden by means of Twitter and Facebook and other social and digital media. Twitter especially carried a great deal of the news burden, and many people were watching the events by means of the Twitter feed rather than watching what had been in the previous means most recently, and that was by some means of the cable news networks. Now, for instance, let me give you a couple of metrics. Twitter says its online traffic, traffic spiked to about 5,000 tweets per second at the beginning and end of President Obama's speech on Sunday night. Now, if you heard that correctly, that's 5,000 tweets per second. Twitter averaged 3,440 tweets per second from 10:45 p.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Sunday night. And that has to be a misprint. That has to mean 12:30 a.m. So in a period of approximately 2 hours, 3,440 tweets per second. As of Monday morning, there were 356,985 likes on Facebook on the page dedicated to Osama bin Laden's death. As this is now reported by John Schwartz of USA Today, the chatter underscored once again the power of social media and the increasing use of Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter as an alternative media source. Peter Chow White, a communications professor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, said, "This is what we are coming to expect nowadays, people witnessing and participating in global conversations about events through a number of media platforms." One man, of course, became his own media platform in the midst of this military operation. The man, Sahib Athar, known on Twitter as Really Virtual, ended up giving a live blog by Twitter of the events as they unfolded, beginning with his first tweet that read rather innocuously, "Helicopter hovering above Abbottabad at 1 a.m. It's a rare event." Well, it turns out that the event was far more rare and far more significant than this man knew. But all of a sudden, he became the man that broke the story worldwide. Los Angeles Times reports something that seems to be a rather clear consequence of this shift to digital media. The headline is this: TV ownership falls for the first time in 20 years. Reuters reports that the number of households in the United States that own television sets is estimated to have declined for the first time in two decades, according to forecast figures from the Nielsen Company that were released on Tuesday. Well, folks, there's no way for television to go but down. What's next? Who knows? Who saw Twitter on the horizon? But here it is. And some of you communicate not only the great events of world occurrence, but the intimate details of your lives by means of Twitter and text messaging. So much for letters, so much for television, so much today for The Briefing. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.